Leaders are all around us. At all times and in every area of our lives, they motivate. They risk the first step. But what motivates a leader? In our Central Texas Leadership Series, KWBU has invited local leaders to talk with people they know who guide and inspire to find out what makes them tick. In this episode, Dr. Peaches Henry, president of the Waco chapter of the NAACP. Hosting the conversation is KWBU President Joe Riley.
Welcome to KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm Joe Riley, talking today with Dr. Peaches Henry, president of the Waco chapter of the NAACP. Welcome, Dr. Henry.
Thank you. Good morning.
There's a lot of things I want to ask you, but part of it, a big part of what we want to do is just get to know you. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a Texas native. I was born in Palestine, Texas, which is almost exactly 2 hours due east of Waco, and born and raised there, small town of about 18,000 people.
So from Palestine to Waco, there was a journey. Now, I understand you went to the University of Texas, and then you went on to graduate school, and you have your doctorate from Columbia, is that right?
That's correct.
In comparative literature?
In English and comparative literature, yes.
English and comparative literature. I was an English major, so, you know, love to know the word out there that you can do anything with a major in English.
Yes, you can.
But you are now president of Waco's NAACP, but you also are teaching at MCC?
Yes, I teach in the English department at MCC. I teach composition and British literature.
Wonderful. When you were growing up, tell us a little bit about what you thought about life, your dreams, what you wanted to do, maybe who influenced you.
Well, I'm one of those people who knew very early what I wanted to do and did not deviate very much from what I called my plan. I always knew that I wanted to be a teacher. And that is the goal that I pursued. I was encouraged by my family, by people at my church and in my community. I grew up in an environment where everyone just thought that you could do anything, and they encouraged you. One of the things that I did during the very early weeks of the pandemic, being quarantined at home, was to go through old letters. And I came across so many letters from teachers and particularly women in my environment, women at my church in particular, and just came across these lovely letters of encouragement from these women. One of the great things about growing up in a small town is that the people with whom you go to church are often the people who also are your teachers, your coaches, so forth and so on. And so my teachers, I encountered both in the school environment and in the church environment. And those letters from decades ago were letters of encouragement. I saw you win this award. Congratulations. I know that you're getting ready to go on a trip. Here's a little piece of change. And there was always that little piece of change to help you along the way. And then just those comments of encouragement. So it was a wonderful environment to grow up in. I never, ever doubted myself because no one around me doubted me. They thought I could do anything.
And this encouragement that you received, did you keep up with these teachers and others through the years?
Oh, yes. My entire family is still in Palestine, though my parents have passed on, but my entire extended family is there. And then all of the people that I grew up, one of the great things about Palestine is that people don't tend to move away. Young people might move away, but eventually they come back, and then people are there for generations. So in fact, not only do people know my story, they know my child's story as well. I spent a 2-year sabbatical in Palestine while I was visiting as a professor at Texas A&M. And my son spent 2 years in the school system there. And he came home one day and said, "Mom, my teacher knows you." And I said to him, "Well, what did she say?" She said to me, "I taught your mother. I taught your grandmother. You better straighten up and fly right." And so, yes, you know, we've kept up with all of those people because they keep up with us and they watch what we do. And, you know, from time to time when, you know, I was younger, finishing up graduate school, beginning my teaching career, I would get a note from time to time from some of those old teachers. Saw that you graduated from graduate school. Congratulations. Saw that you're teaching. Glad to see it. So, yes, those people kept up with me, and I keep up with them.
Are there students that you have now that you keep up with through the years?
You know, I just recently got an email from a student that I taught. It's been about 15 years ago now in Wyoming, where I taught for a couple of years. And he was looking for me. And he wrote to remind me of a course that he had taken from me and to tell me how much he had enjoyed that. So from time to time, I do hear from students. And it's a wonderful thing because it's rare that teachers see the impact they've had on students, because students take your class, take your course, and they move on. It's rare that students reach back and let you know. Just last Christmas, again, I got a note from another student who was actually a student in the very first class I taught as a brand new teacher. And she was telling me the impact that I had had on her life. And I just would not have expected it. She was such a quiet young woman. So, of course, I had no idea at the time that I had impacted her. So it is always very gratifying when students let you know that you've impacted them.
How did you make the move into now also not just teaching, but you're president of the local Waco chapter of the NAACP?
Growing up, every Black person that I knew was a part of the NAACP. I went off to college and started my career and was not as involved in the NAACP as I had been growing up. And like a lot of Black people, you know, thought that we had won the Civil Rights War and that we were all free and we could pursue our lives. And I'll tell you, the Trayvon Martin case just rattled me. At the time, my son was also in high school. My son was also a young man who liked to wear hoodies. And in fact, he was getting ready to go off to the University of Texas. And when that case was decided, it was late at night. It was late at night when he got home. He didn't get home till about 11 o'clock that night because he was working. He walks in the door and he says to me about the clothes that we had been purchasing for school. He goes, "Mom, I don't want any more hoodies in my wardrobe for UT." He didn't say anything else. That was all that he said. But that meant that he didn't want to be another Trayvon Martin. That case touched me so deeply because I knew that my straight-A student, my Eagle Scout son walking down the street could have easily been Trayvon Martin. And that just prompted me to get back in the game, to get back in the fight for civil rights, and to realize that though we were convinced that we had arrived, we had not. And that the war for civil rights and social justice and criminal justice was an ongoing war that I needed to be a part of.
This summer, NPR has been compiling stories in a special series that they call America Reckons with Racial Injustice. And so while this has just come into sharp focus in the news in the last few months and going back a little bit further than that, so is it fair to say that it's not new or sudden to you?
No, it's not new or sudden to me and to other Black people. What I find ironic is that a lot of people, and by a lot of people, I mean a lot of white people, are suddenly woke. And I say to people, look, we've been woke for a long time because we cannot afford to sleep about this. So it is not new. What I feel now is that white people are beginning to understand what I, as an African-American parent, live with every single day. And so I no longer have sometimes white friends of mine, sometimes white acquaintances, what I call white-splaining, explaining to me why the victim of police brutality was deserving, how he or she didn't do something right, didn't comply in the right way, or even to explain to me that what I saw with my eyes was not what I saw. So this is a moment. It is an important moment for us to begin to look at this issue with clear eyes. And let me say now that the notion that people who utter the words Black Lives Matter do not care about the lives of police and do not support the police, that is erroneous. We do. The difficulty for me as an African American mother especially is that when my son leaves my home to run early in the morning as he did before he went back to college, he doesn't know which police officer he's going to encounter. Is he going to encounter the one who intends to protect all of the community? Or is he going to encounter the one who's like the one who put his knee on George Floyd's neck? And because we don't know which one we're going to encounter, we are always anxious when we encounter law enforcement. Not because we don't trust them and want them to protect us, but because we are unsure which version we are going to encounter. And we have to be prepared for the worst, because if we're not, it could mean our lives or the lives of our children.
We hear a lot of people talking today about racial justice and racial equity. Are justice and equity the same thing?
In a sense, I would say that they are, but I think that what we want to talk about more right now and to separate the two is to talk about equity and to talk about everyone having a good shot at having a healthy life. And what does that mean? Well, we're seeing what it means to not have equity in our community during this worldwide pandemic. We're seeing that there is a connection between who has the wealth and who has the health, that there is a real connection between individuals, for example, who have health care through their employers, people who actually have a family doctor. Something so simple as a family doctor determine whether or not you were tested for COVID-19 early in the process. Economic concerns, depending on where you lived in the county, could determine whether or not you received a COVID test. So these issues of equity are connected to every part of our lives. So I'm glad that we are in a moment now in our country when people are beginning to learn such terms and to understand what they mean and to know that we must make a concerted effort toward racial equity, toward economic equity, because all aspects of our lives are connected to that issue.
For those who are just joining us, this is KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm Joe Riley, talking today with Dr. Peaches Henry, the president of Waco's chapter of the NAACP. Waco has been making moves. I know that the racial equity Institute has been offering training for the last couple of years, that the city of Waco has been making some moves, that the Waco Foundation adopted a new vision and value statement, making racial equity one of its priorities. What is your take on the work that's going on locally in this community?
I am very pleased with the work that is going on through the Race Equity Institute. Offerings that we've had over the course of the years. I'm very impressed with what the city is doing toward racial equity. I understand now that the city is actually going to have an office of equity, and I'm very excited about that. What it requires of us at this moment is, first of all, to learn and understand about issues such as systemic racism. People should understand that talking about race equity does not mean that people are being attacked individually or even that they are being accused somehow of being racist, though I do believe that racists exist in our culture. But it is not a personal attack on individuals. But what people must realize is that there are lingering institutions, systems in place that have unequal implications for people of color. So what the Race Equity Institute does is to remove all emotion from that and literally just marches down through history, the history of the United States, about simple laws. You know, people think that redlining, for example, was put in place by individuals, local communities. It was not. Redlining was put into place by the United States federal government, where they literally drew lines on maps in communities and said, do not allow people of the African-American race to buy homes outside of this area or inside another area. And so what the Race Equity Institute does is to teach people about those various kinds of laws and then to think about how America generates wealth. Well, we generate wealth by passing down the wealth accumulated around home ownership. And so when you pack people into really dense areas and they're unable to purchase homes outside of those areas in more affluent areas, they won't be able to pass down wealth. Now, that's a generational situation. And so a person who has been the beneficiary of that ability to pass down race, well, that person has had the privilege of doing that. And so that person is not guilty, but that person has received that privilege. And so when we talk about racial equity and understanding it, that's what we need to come to understand. And that's what I believe that the Race Equity Institute, the Community Race Relations Coalition, the NAACP, the City of Waco, we are working to educate our community and then to make some steps toward racial equity, toward things like economic equity, so that people will be able to pass down wealth and create generational wealth in their families.
Tell us a little bit about the local chapter of the NAACP. As I understand, and I was surprised when I saw it, it was actually formed in 1936, and I was really surprised at
that early year. The Waco NAACP, from its inception in 1936, has been a highly active chapter. And in years past, the chapter held state conventions here. It was a part of the national chapter. It provided, particularly when Paul Quinn College was located here. So we had this active center of intellectual and cultural activities going on. And because of that, we're able to attract national speakers and activists to Waco. So as a result of that, Waco is a very active chapter, and we've continued to be so. We are working in what we call game changer activities. So we are interested in education. We are interested in economics, in health, in political engagement, because we believe if we are active in those areas, we will impact our community. And so, of course, for the last 6 months since the pandemic broke, we've been interested in three areas. We've been interested in health, we've been interested in economics, and we've been interested in criminal justice. Because not only did we have the pandemic and the resulting economic situations, but then in the midst of that, we had the George Floyd situation occur as well. And so our task is always to educate and energize the community to get involved, because the chapter is only as strong as its membership. And our membership here in Waco is very, very strong and active.
How many members?
We have a little over 250 members.
I know that recently, and in fact currently, Waco is looking for a new police chief. And I know during the first round, you spoke up to make sure that the community listened, that it was not simply a we're gonna just choose here. And I know that as a result, that search was pulled back, and they took a second look. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
Well, the first thing I want to do is to commend the city of Waco for realizing that when we first began our search for a police chief, we were in a very different historical moment. And then as a result of the George Floyd murder, as well as the protests that followed across the world, not just across the nation, that we're in a different historical moment. So I commend the city of Waco for realizing that as well. But from the very beginning of the search, our chapter has always been interested in hiring a person of color in that position. Now, that does not mean that we don't believe that a Caucasian police chief could not have led us through this moment and moving forward. We've only had Caucasian police chiefs up to this point. But we also believe that there are candidates of color who could also successfully fulfill that position. And we supported a person of color for numerous reasons. For one, symbolic. That is really to have law officers as well as the community to see somebody that reflects a different part of our culture. But also, we believe that having someone of color who understands what it means to be a person of color who engages with law enforcement was very important. And we know that we have stories all the way down from the president to the local area where we have black men and women who encounter police officers and are not always involved in what are positive situations. When I first moved to Waco, driving through one of our smaller suburbs, I'll call them, with three boys in the back, all of them Boy Scouts, one my son and the other two Caucasian, I was pulled over. And I'm driving through a neighborhood, and, you know, I'm pulled over. You know, I'm asked, what am I doing? And I'm like, I'm going home here. And, you know, my driver's license, I got three little boys in the back, and there was never an explanation of why I was pulled over. I had done nothing wrong. I was not speeding, but here I was apparently in the wrong neighborhood. So those kinds of encounters, we believe that a police chief of color probably has had them before. And then, so just understanding that, I think, is important. And then there are other reasons as well. We were looking for a police chief who could begin to help create trust in the community. And that's not to say that the community does not have trust with the several police chiefs that I have been involved with. But again, we're at a moment in our country where that kind of trust needs to be built. I am of the mind that the attitude of any organization is established by the leadership. And so we were also interested in a police chief of color who could impact his officers or her officers in a way that would be good for the community.
Those three things you mentioned, the pandemic as a priority, the economy as a priority, racial equity as a priority, and the justice system.
Criminal
justice. Now we have another layer on that in terms of timing, is that's the election.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, as we record this, we're sort of in the shadow of the election, just is coming up. Where is the NAACP involved? How is the NAACP involved in that?
The NAACP sees this election as one of the most crucial elections, not just of our lifetime, but of several generations. And so our goal is to get people registered to vote and then to get them to vote in numbers that they have never voted in before. And Texas is often known as the no voting state. And so we want to make sure that that is a label that changes this election. And so we are encouraging people to make a plan to vote. So we're encouraging people, if you want to vote by mail, to request your vote by mail application right now. And then as soon as you get your ballot, to cast that ballot and then get it to the post office. If you don't trust the post office because we're having issues with that, actually take it down to the elections office and they will accept it from you. We're also encouraging people to vote during early voting. We have an extra week of early voting, and so we'll be able to vote for 3 weeks beginning on October the 13th and running through October the 30th. And then, of course, people should feel free to vote on Election Day, which is Tuesday, November the 3rd. And we're asking people to come prepared to stay in line. In Texas, we can no longer vote a straight party ticket, which means that it is going to take longer. In addition, we've had to move the city and the county elections to November from May because of the pandemic. So we're asking people to come, be prepared to stand in line. Bring your water, bring your hat, bring your cell phone charger so that you can stay in line. And so that's what we are working to do, is to get everybody to get out and vote.
We are out of time. I knew this was going to happen, that I'd have a list of questions and we'd get through. But this has been a wonderful conversation, and I'm so glad you've come out to talk with us. It's good to meet you and to get to know a little bit about you, and for our listeners to get to know you a little bit better as well. And so thank you so much, Dr. Henry.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
This conversation was recorded September 29th, 2020, in the KWBU studio.